Welcome to Side by Side, a podcast where I, Robert Kwong, take you inside conversations with artists, creatives, healers, and warriors taking the charge in their transformational story. Today's guest is Master Certified Coach, business owner, and vocalist Elena Armijo. In this conversation, we commiserate a little over our artistic and musical roots and explore Elena's journey from the world of opera to working with leaders and teams as a coach and facilitator. She is the founder of the C-Suite Collective, an executive coaching agency offering in-depth, customized programs for high performers. And she is the host of The Collective Corner, a podcast where badass, inspiring, and compassionate conversations get to flourish. Well, it's nice to meet you, Elena. I had just shared this before we started recording, but your name has come up so often and clearly as a positive influence in so many of my peers and even mentors. So it's so nice to be connecting with you today. How are you?
Oh, the same with you. Anytime I can connect with any coach and musician at the same time makes my heart so happy. So thank you for having me and allowing me to be here.
I think we'll have a lot to talk about in those areas in particular. Maybe just as a natural question, how's your new year so far in 2023?
My new year has been intentional, would be the word that I would use. I typically like to end my years with more reflection and more quiet time than hop into what's next mode, which is a very US American based mentality. So I intentionally set up the end of the year to slow way down and listen and get quiet. And I also hold the reins back a bit when January starts. Most people around me want to go pretty fast. And so I'm always the one that's slowing people down in my life to continue to listen. And that being said, it's been busier than I would have liked in January. even despite my efforts to slow things down, I think we've had a lot more possibility and humans come through the door that we wanted to get served. So that has been my January so far. How about yours?
My new year has been also a bit of a roller coaster so far, but in a, I would say in a good way. And something that I want to get used to as far as a rhythm for this year might be more kind of kinetic motion and more action oriented this year for me. So, as a natural kind of introvert who likes to stay in a closed piano studio, and I've been for so many years, there's another part of being a coach and business owner that's front facing that I am okay with accepting in some ways. So, yeah, also kind of a busy start. And I'm not sure, I know you grew up in New Mexico, but where are you currently based?
I'm currently based in Los Angeles. My partner, Aaron, and I moved here about a year and a couple months ago from New York. We were in New York for 14 years. He's from New York, so he grew up in the New Jersey area. And I relocated to New York in 2007 from New Mexico and Seattle, where I had done my master's in music. So I'd been there for quite a while, and we decided to move to Los Angeles a year ago. And it was really to expand both of our businesses. We'd done the pandemic in New York, and that was really powerful to be, you know, we were one of the lucky ones. We had a space that actually supported us both being at home, and he was already set up with his studio. And so when the pandemic happened, I felt really grateful for our space in New York the way it was. And there was a lot that happened in New York during the pandemic years. And so I think at the end of those 2 years, we just sort of looked at each other and said, it feels like it's time for something new. And we want to expand into something that's a different energy than what we were in. And so we chose Los Angeles. And I got to say, I don't hate not being in winters anymore on the East Coast. You know, the winters are pretty rough there. So we've been enjoying 2 winters now in Los Angeles.
I'm from Colorado, and you would think that I will be fine with the cold, and I am. But there's something about the East Coast winter that's very humid that I absolutely cannot. It's on another level because it just makes everything even more intense when the weather swings in. And Colorado just doesn't have that. And people always say, aren't you a mountain man? But
I get that.
Growing up in New Mexico, I know you've talked about mm-hmm. in different spaces mm-hmm. that you grew up in a very, first of all, it was very influential and that you grew up in a very mm-hmm. diverse and multicultural community. I'm really curious if you could expand on that and what are some core memories that really informed your perspective on life, especially, I assume, as you got older, where you went to other spaces where that wasn't just the default, you know? Yeah. I'm really curious, what are some things that made growing up in New Mexico so interesting for you?
What a beautiful question. One of the things that I had always heard growing up was that New Mexico was magical. And I didn't know what that meant. You know, when you're from somewhere, you don't really see the gifts until you leave and you come back of a place. And many people, when I grew up, had expressed how magical New Mexico was. And what I learned as an older adult was that it really is a spiritual place. It's a grounded place. If you study some of the energy work that's in the world, it's on a couple of distinct lines of energy that cross through there that make it one of the most spiritual places. There's a couple points all over the world that exist, and New Mexico has one. So I think that with that in mind, it brings a lot of different types of people to New Mexico that get curious about the energy there. And growing up, I always got to see different families come through and different age ranges of people that would come and be curious about New Mexico. So that was one way that I got to experience some diversity and different cultures that passed through. And then there's also a huge military presence in Fort Bliss in El Paso, Texas, which is right on the border where I lived in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And so there was also a lot of military life and a lot of different people that came through from the military that also shaped experiences were like there. I'm trying to think what other ways I got to see people. There's a very famous opera house. The Santa Fe Opera House exists in Santa Fe. So, you know, people who were music connoisseurs came from all over the world to see that mm-hmm. opera house as well. And Taos and Santa Fe are really known as the more healing-centered places in New Mexico. So we would travel up there sometimes as a kid and just get to walk around and be exposed to artwork and music and life. And the drive between Santa Fe and Albuquerque and Las Cruces is very long because New Mexico is quite a large state with not a lot of things in between. So you could be driving in the desert for hours and not see anything. You know, when you're doing that, you're left with your thoughts, thoughts about the world and thoughts about yourself. So those are some of my core memories from childhood that I have that might have shaped, you know, my way of thinking. And also a really special place is White Sands, which is a national monument. And it's the residue of the ocean that turned to white sand, which you can't really find anywhere else in the US like this. And so that place is also, you go there and the night, if you go on a night where it's a full moon, it's the whole sand just glows. Everything glows around you. So I like to say that I was connected to nature and the desert and some mystical experiences out there that, again, when I was a kid, didn't really mean much to me. But now looking back as an adult, I think they might have set a foundation for all of the work that I do in the world and the music I made in the world.
Growing up, were you in a musical family? Were you surrounded by things like music? What were you into?
I did have a musical family. My grandmother migrated over from Peru, and she was a classical pianist. She came to the States to play classical piano, and she quickly fell in love with a banker from California. So she stopped playing once she got here, and so she didn't get very far with her musical endeavors. But she was a very beautiful pianist. And my father played trumpet in high school, so he had a little bit of music in his background. And my mom loves to sing, although she will quickly tell you that she's never been trained or, you know, has what she always likes to say that she has a voice that's always off key, which I may or may not agree with. But what I will say is that we loved music in our family. So music was always playing. I was always playing the radio. My mom or my dad were always playing the radio. They they met and fell in love, you know, dancing in bars. And that was the thing that they would do, is they'd go out dancing together as a couple early on in their marriage. So I do think music was a part of my background since I was little, and I naturally leaned towards it. So they encouraged it. You know, they got me piano lessons when I was in fifth grade. And then by the time I got to sixth grade, I started taking voice lessons. And that was a really big deal for them because they'd never really paid for something professional themselves. And at that point, it was hard to come up with money for lessons, but they did and they encouraged it. And I think I just kept getting encouragement every step of the way from everyone. So, you know, I won solo and ensemble competitions in middle school. And then in high school, I was part of the swing choir and the jazz choir and the, you know, the modern airs is what we called it in Cruces High. And so was constantly performing. And then that led to, you know, undergrad at New Mexico State, where I got an education degree in music, but also it was a small enough school where you got a lot of opportunity to perform as well. So it felt like I was getting an education and a performance degree at the same time. So my whole journey, people just kind of kept saying, here, you're good at this. Keep going, keep going.
So New Mexico really are in your roots. And I have quick disclaimer. I have, in high school, me and my friends decided to do a road trip through New Mexico. So I've been to Taos, New Mexico. And I remember that place being my favorite. Randomly bumped into William H. Macy there.
Yeah.
I was like, what is happening in New Mexico that I don't know about? You know, that was, it was kind of that experience.
The hidden gems.
exactly. And I would love to revisit sometimes. And talking about your undergrad experience, that was when you decided to major or specialize in opera singing specifically?
Yeah. You know, I had such a robust music education in high school that when I got to my undergrad was sort of when the beautiful teachers that I worked with were sort of like, you need to choose. You got to choose. You can't do everything in music. And I really resisted that. I was very resentful of that. I was like, no, I should be able to sing anything I want. They're like, well, you can. And there's a possibility if you don't, that you can really specialize and get really good at one thing. So I loved jazz music, but I was really too young to be singing jazz. Like when I would sing a jazz song, it was kind of silly because I didn't have any life experience to go with the jazz music. Yeah. So I chose to focus on classical music solely. And I was a bit heartbroken about it, but the voice grew very quickly. And while I was singing and studying opera, it just became a really natural fit in my voice. So I decided to take their advice and just focus on opera while I was an undergrad.
And something that people don't know about opera singers is that you have to sing in multiple languages.
Yes.
And you have a way of having to be with and also perform linguistics and song at the same time.
Yes.
And in fact, you have a piece of trivia on your website that's about you can sing in any language. And I was curious if you could elaborate or explain what that means for someone. Yeah.
Well, it's a really interesting system that we're taught in undergrad. So a lot of people have the misconception that you have to be fluent in every language you sing in, and you don't, although that's really nice and helpful because, you know, the further along I got in my opera career, the more I wished I was fluent in a lot of those languages. But we study something called the International Phonetic Alphabet, which is just a system that is put on any language to be able to pronounce any language correctly. So you had to do double work, right? You had to take out this alphabet. You had to sit down and figure out how to pronounce Russian on top of it. But then you had to translate everything because you can't just know how to pronounce it, right? Because then, you know, you'd be up there singing about things you don't know or you don't understand. So then you'd have to translate the whole thing. Then you'd have to memorize the translation and the pronunciation and really embody it so that when you actually stepped on stage, you could really portray what the composer and the librettist wanted you to portray. So there was a whole system of having to learn these things outside of just studying for like Italian 101, which I was also doing, was, you know, studying how to speak Italian fluently.
Yeah, Italian being definitely one of the languages that opera singers have to be familiar with. And it makes me curious, though, because a lot of your work involves communications. You're a coach, you're a facilitator, a leader. You have your own podcast in different spaces and platforms. How much of the skill sets and the muscles that you had to use as an opera singer translates into the work that you do now?
Well, I think that I talk about this a lot. You know, what I look for in clients and companies that I work with is excellence versus perfection. That's something that we talk about a lot. And when I look at what was required of me to study opera and become a singer, there was resilience, there was consistency, there were skills that I developed that enabled excellence. And there was a piece of me that, because I wasn't actually doing it from an authentic place, which I'm sure we'll get into in a little bit, I wasn't really embracing music from what I wanted. I was doing it from what other people thought I should do. That tended to breed perfectionist qualities, right? And perfectionism, which is a losing battle for everyone. So a lot of the work that I talk about with clients is, what is the difference between perfection and excellence? And where does it start? And how can you choose it intentionally? And how can you develop it inside yourself? So I think those are some of the skills that transfer over right away. And then there's something about being elite, you know, being an elite performer. And I'm sure you feel this way as well with your music, that it takes a certain amount of practice to call yourself a master at something. And so when you get to that level, like the infamous 10,000 hours it takes to be a master at something, you really get to let go of some of those constructs that were placed on you to really create art, or excellence is another way of saying that. So those are some of the tangible skills that I bring in right away. But I think the more important conversation that I love to bring into rooms is creativity again, because oftentimes I find in rooms where there is excellence or high achievers or performers, they have forgotten that there is some beautiful magic in creativity, which is where music for me started, was getting creative about the ways I could express myself or the things I wanted to say, even with a structure that was given to me. So that's one of my favorite things, is to go into a room and remind people that they have a lot more intuition and creative power than they remember.
Yes, keyword being remember, especially when we were young and
yeah,
had that freedom, that inner spirit that, depending on how you train and cultivate yourself, can be amplified or start to strip away in some ways, including in a place like music conservatory.
Yeah.
So fast forward a few years and you are a working professional, an opera singer. Mm-hmm. Could you describe what might be like a typical week for a working professional opera singer, and what that looked like for you, and maybe why some of that informed your decision to pivot?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh my gosh. A typical week at that time. And this is, you know, I pivoted from singing full time in 2015. So this is about 7 years ago when this was happening. At this point, a typical week would look like I would wake up, and usually I was sleeping in a little bit from the night before, because if it was either a performance or usually a performance or a gig that I'd done, I need to rest a little bit and rest the voice. So I would give myself as much possible time in the morning to not talk until, like, you know, 9 or 10 a.m. Then I'd wake up and I'd make some breakfast, and I'd immediately open score study and start studying, you know, whatever was coming up next, whether it was an audition or a role that I was prepping for. And I usually would spend about 2 hours of score study. And that could include anything from diction work to acting work to singing in real time. Any given day, I would try to sing 2 hours a day because it was building up stamina, but it was also me working on the roles that I was booked to do. Then it was usually lunchtime, and I'd grab something quick, and usually had an audition scheduled. So I'd run to an audition, you know, and go audition for the next season. And something that people don't realize about opera, which is a little bit different than like acting, or yeah, I guess acting would be a great comparison, is that you have a window of when auditions happen for seasons. So there's usually like 4 or 5 months that all the opera companies are doing their auditions, and you have to do as many auditions as you possibly can to set yourself up for the next year or the year after. So there's a period of 4 months there where you're auditioning, and I would try to do like 80 auditions in 4 months to maybe land 5 to 10 gigs for the following year. And that would be a way that I would try to fill my calendar with actual opera shows. And then you do the things in between, like booking small gigs at a restaurant near you, or, you know, singing at a nursing home, or singing with Sing for Hope, or things like that, that I would fill in around that. But really, there was always this intense period of the year where you were auditioning, and that was 80% of your job. Mm-hmm. And so then you might go home and rest and change, and then it was time to go to rehearsal for the night, you know? So you'd go out and you'd be at rehearsal for 4 or 5 hours and come home and do the whole thing again. And it was nonstop. I think there was a period there where I like to tell people that for 4 years straight, I was on the road 10 months out of the year when I would sit down and actually count up all the weeks in the calendar. Mm-hmm. And there was only 2 months that I was not traveling, or I was like coming to New York to change my clothes or my suitcase. And it could be anything from like, I was going to a young artist program, or I was going to an opera for a month to be on staff for a month. So it just became exhausting. I was traveling a lot. I was doing well. I wouldn't say I was doing really, really well. Like, I wasn't singing at Verona or the Met yet, but I could see that if I continued what I was doing, that I would end up in those places. And I remember singing at Syracuse Opera. This is the opera house where I really felt in the moment that something needed to change. And it had nothing to do with Syracuse or the staff or anything there. It was just, I remember singing Stefano, which is not a really big role for a mezzo. It's a very tiny role. So, you know, not a lot of work that I had to do there, but I remember taking a bow on stage, and the audience that night was super generous and grateful with their applause for the entire cast. And, you know, it was this feeling of like love and reverence, and so much beautiful music had just happened on stage. And then I went backstage and I got undressed from my costume and I put on my snow boots because it was Syracuse in the middle of the winter and it was snowing. And I walked back to my artist apartment, which is, you know, an apartment they give you when you're on a gig. And I'd forgotten to go to the grocery store. And I knew that the grocery store was closed because it was, you know, late at night after the show. And I was so angry. I remember just thinking, what is happening? Like, I'm tired. I'm exhausted. I'm alone. I think I was on my third failed relationship at that point. There was no groceries in the house. There wasn't anywhere I was going to go get any food late at night. So it was another night where I was just going to try to piece it together. And I was really sad and I was really lonely and frustrated and angry. I think I have more language now than I did then, because then it was just sort of like I was mad. And, you know, I took a deep breath and I really looked around, and I remember sitting on the floor of that apartment that night and just thinking, this is not working. Like, something has to give and something has to change, because I am so unhappy and I have no reason to be, right? Like, there were thousands of singers who would have chosen to be in my position and would be thrilled and happy. And I wasn't. And so I was carrying a lot of guilt. I'd had this whole journey my whole life. You know, there were so many people behind me that believed in me and had supported me. And it felt like a huge betrayal to want to do something else, you know, in spite of all of that. So I just remember feeling like pretty low, so much so that I reached out to a friend and they told me about a coach they were working with. So I decided to hire this coach. I think I called the next day and got a consultation with her when I got back to New York, and hired the coach. And during that time, over the next 6 months, I really unpacked how I had created my career. And what I learned was pretty, I don't want to say it was shocking, but it was grounding. It was pretty, like an aha moment in your life, where I realized that I'd spent my entire opera career proving to the world that I was worthy, that I was able to do this hard thing from, as you know, a country girl from New Mexico, that I was able to surpass all the odds, and that I could be tough and I could be resilient. And that if everyone was giving me all this applause and these accolades and these roles, that I was safe and I was loved and I was happy and, or should be, right? And when I realized that I think that was the first moment when I worked with the coach that I realized that I had never intended to make music a business ever. Like, I loved music, but I had never intended. I had always wanted to teach elementary music or do something fun like that. And to me, being on stage was not really what I wanted. But more importantly, I didn't want to make a career out of it. And that took a lot of guts to have to admit that after everything I'd been through. And to say, okay,
yeah,
if this is not what you want, then what do you want? And at that point, I joined a coach training program, which is the same coach training program you did, I think, accomplishment coaching. And I still to this day laugh, because I joined it not because I wanted to be a coach, but because I thought it was the quickest way I could fix myself, which, is an alignment high achievers and performers do, especially in the opera world. It's like, oh, you want me to learn Russian for this role? Like by next week? Great. No problem. Right. So yeah. Same thing.
Go
with
for the most intense
training.
Way possible.
That's right. This is the most intense. This is it. I'll never have to do it again. I'll fix myself and we'll be done with this conversation. And that's just such a huge joke now, right? Because you get in that room and you start doing more transformational work and you realize, number one, that you're going to be doing that work for your whole life. But number two, I fell in love with coaching and I never had found something that I loved as much as I love music. And so for the first time, I could really envision a world where I was coaching full time and making a business out of it, but got to sing on my terms and got to really intentionally create how this goes.
Oh, that's so interesting that you're mentioning that alongside coaching and coaching training and starting a business, mm-hmm. you were able to cultivate a different relationship to singing.
Yeah, in real time.
Creative expression. Mm-hmm. It wasn't an either or, which we tend to mm-hmm. get into a lot.
Yeah. Well, and I want to be clear, it took a long time to get there. I had to do a lot of healing work around myself and around music to be able to step into that again, but it didn't take very long to actually see, oh, wait a minute, music didn't do anything to me, right? Those were all the choices I made. So, and to have a different relationship now, where now I can just sing for fun. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, to stay in the music world a little bit more, it's so funny you bring up the word proving, because so much mm-hmm. of the education, the cultivation of an artist with the auditions to the juries, to pleasing your piano teacher or your voice teacher, so much mm-hmm. of it is based on some kind of external measurement of where we are and excellence, like you say. And there is quite a bit of perfectionism that I've seen and experienced myself and get over as an artist. How can someone work with somebody like a coach or a one-on-one type of dynamic relationship like that, that can really support something that's about something very intrinsic, internal, such as mm-hmm. your creative expression and your value as an artist? This can take quite a bit of time to sort of unpack for an individual, but how can coaching support something like that?
Oh, I think coaching can help in so many ways. This is actually why I still reserve always and probably will forever and ever to sliding scale spots in my practice for musicians, because I really truly believe that the power of coaching, if I had the tools that I have now, then I might have made a different decision and I might not have left the industry from a business perspective. I didn't love it, so I don't know if that's really true. It's kind of unfair to say what I would or wouldn't have done, but I know I would have had a different experience and then the ability to choose powerfully instead of choosing from a place of like, I can't do this anymore. Right. And that's really all I would have ever wanted. Mm-hmm. And so I think working with a coach and what I work with artists on now is kind of deprogramming some of these things that we're taught as musicians that it needs to be 100% perfect. It needs to be technically correct and proficient. And look, there is a time and a place for that training. And then there is also developing you as a soul and a human from authentic expression and having it be okay that you get on stage and you give the performance of your life where you feel the most connected with spirit or the most connected with what you want to say and give to the audience. And maybe you missed five notes too. And that is the cream of the crop, right? That is actually a beautiful experience to have, as opposed to what happened to me. I sang at Carnegie Hall and I got on stage and I was technically perfect. And I don't remember half of it because I was so scared and so checked out and so worried about being perfect and honoring everybody that came before me on that stage and all the stories that I had in my head, as opposed to letting it be an experience that both I had and the audience had together in that moment. Like, how cool would that have been to really have the mindset that this is no longer about anything that we've been told in the practice room or through our teachers, and instead is about a moment and an experience. And so I think that's the work to do with artists, because from that place, you can create infinite art and you can notice when your tank is low and you need to source up, or when you're not taking care of yourself, which from the old place where I was coming from, it was never going to be enough. And I felt like I had to say yes to contracts because I didn't know if I was going to eat, you know? And so I think there's just some reprogramming that coaches can help with that really break down some of those limiting beliefs and have you step fully into what you're choosing, which then I truly believe only creates the most authentic version of art that you want to have in the world, which is powerful.
Yeah. It's so powerful. And also it so resonates with me because it explains some of why during coaching training with Accomplishment, I started, well, and this was during the pandemic. So we were all home a lot more. Mm-hmm. I had a keyboard with me. And it was during then that I started having a new relationship with the piano that I never had before while I was getting sort of intensive coaching training, yes. Which you know how intense it can get.
Yeah.
And I kept, you know, since then, I think I'm still finding the language of what was it about this kind of experience over here that also kind of jump-started this whole other life for me as a musician that I just didn't see for myself when I was in conservatory, you know, a reputable conservatory at that, right? And blah, blah, blah. So I just want to say that so much of working with our purpose, our voice, our values and all of that and having our breakthroughs can so help create new life for an artist in a way that maybe is not always there by default in arts and arts education.
Yes, yes.
And there's a word that I see in some of the spaces that you own and share with others. One is the space, the Collective Corner, which is your podcast, that where you have conversations with industry experts, creatives, artists, to have really soulful, in-depth conversations. Mm-hmm. And you are also a part of, and I believe the founder, right, of the C-Suite Collective.
Yes. Yeah.
And both those times, the word collective comes up. And I see that as a word that you really want to amplify. What is it about the word collective that resonates with you and your vision?
One of the pieces of my vision are that we change culture from the inside out with companies. And this includes artistic organizations. You know, I this year have been working with a lot of organizations that I used to sing with that were really changing how do courageous conversations and belonging and connection look inside these organizations. And what does that mean for artists then? But also private equity, tech, startups, all of them, right? The common theme is that we're working with people to really change their experience of connection and belonging to then create their vision instead of just more productivity or keeping people aboard or afloat in the company or having diversity just to have diversity. It's a deeper conversation around what people then get to experience and how they're seen and felt in workplace culture. So the reason I chose the word collective is I believe that's what we're all up here doing in the world as a human race, as the collective of the human race. We are all, everyone wants to be seen and everyone wants to feel like they belong and everyone has gifts to bring. And so when it's a collective of humans instead of experts or knowledgeable people that are leading the way and we should follow them, much like, you know, with our teachers and coaches that we have in the music world, which I love them. I think they're powerful, powerful people. And sometimes when we don't trust that we all have gifts to bring or all of us have intuition and that collectively together we can actually make the world a better place to live in and experience, we get into a little bit of trouble. Right? With power dynamics or control or fear. And I'm not saying that those things won't ever exist in our world, but I think there's power in doing this as a collective to raise the bar or the consciousness of how we experience each other. And so that's my grand vision of the world is that that's a new way of leadership and a new paradigm of leadership that we haven't seen yet. And so I created a company that will always be a collective. Instead of a company, you know, that is that has hierarchy and power dynamics. And even though that will exist, because that exists naturally inside of it, my hope is that if we remain in community and treat each other like a collective and that we all have gifts, that we will continue to support each other in all those gifts.
Well, and I know some of this, you would have to respect confidentiality, but based on your experience working with C-suite teams and organizations, mm-hmm. What are some things that you've seen that has been really a focus, or maybe you're seeing as sort of the direction that leadership or leadership roles are headed towards, that you've seen because of your particular vantage point as a facilitator and a coach?
I think that the courageous companies, the companies that are willing to take some chances, are really moving towards this conversation that we're having right now, which is focusing on their people from a holistic and human aspect. So in the pandemic, I saw a lot of C-suite teams slow way down because they had to, right? And then listen to their people, because we had a lot of social unrest and racial inequity in our country that has always been there, but really came to the forefront. So then everybody was in that conversation and talking about feelings for the first time in a long time in companies. And then we saw a progression of movement where those same teams started to get frustrated, right? We're having all these gorgeous conversations about emotions and feelings, and we still aren't getting anything done. And now we need to go back to getting things done. And so what I'm seeing is there is a handful of companies that are wanting to remain where they were or go back to the way things were. And they're willing to just do the same old things that they knew before the pandemic to try to get this, you know, their companies back where they want them to be. But the courageous young leaders who are willing to try something different are still in the reinvention conversation. And those companies are actually producing legacy and people staying around, and they're not having problems with quiet quitting or the resignation, the great resignation. Even in the recession, they are still producing more possibility and more opportunity for their companies because they have slowed down and they're taking this holistic approach. And when I say holistic approach, I mean leaving space for courageous, hard conversations, making sure their people are supported, making sure that they're also watching their bottom line and they're not overspending or overcommitting, making sure that they have their eye on burnout as a marker or a flag to pay attention to, as opposed to just a way of being in a company. So these are the companies I get really excited about working with, because those young C-suite teams, and I'm saying young, and it's really like 35 or 40 year olds up to 55 year olds or 60 year olds right now, are really in that cool spot where they get to reinvent how this goes, to be in partnership with the next generation coming up, mm-hmm. as opposed to the older generation, who some of them are listening and they're noticing and they're watching and they're also coming over to this side of the table. But the ones who aren't are slowly seeing that it's not, they're being left behind. And I think we always knew that that might happen. That was my prediction in 2020 when all this started, was if you're a company that's resisting this change or this reinvention, then you might hang on for a little while, but where are you going to end up is really the larger conversation. And we're starting to see the results of some of that.
Oh, that's so fascinating, especially within the framework of being a part of a collective for these companies and these young leaders, and not having that top-down model, the paradigm so much. And similarly, the coaching industry has probably really had to examine itself over the past few years, and just the working conditions and the expectations of even something like the training program we were a part of. Mm-hmm. I was part of a program that just had to be virtual, even though it was very well established and known to be a live in-person training experience and part of the package. What are some things that you've seen for the coaching industry itself now at the dawn of 2023 and the future that maybe you're hoping for or looking for our industry?
Yeah, well, I'm hoping for us to be the leaders, like to go first. You know, in a lot of these conversations that we're talking about, we are the ones that are change agents. So if we're standing for what we want, what we see, we gotta go first, right? So I'm really hoping to see more diversity come up the ranks in credentialing. You know, when I got my MCC, I don't have the stats off the top of my head, but I think it was something like only 2% of MCCs in the coaching industry were BIPOC. And that was really heartbreaking to me. I see it changing. I see our industry entertaining more and more conversations and training to become more informed about healing based leadership and opening up mindsets to blind spots and doing our own work on dismantling systems that oppress people. So I think we're in the middle of it, and I'm excited to see what comes in the next 10 to 15 years. And I also think that we're on the same, you know, we're on the same journey that all these companies are on, which means that in another 10 to 15 years, we're going to have a whole different style of leaders that are leading the industry. And I'm really excited to see what that brings, because I think that there's so much possibility when we let new ideas come in and new ways of being come in that aren't just the old way. And, you know, I say this to a lot of coaches that are entering the business. The coaching business exploded in the last 3 years. It really, like, it grew exponentially, and there's still a lot of noise in the industry. So I'm also excited to see how the industry shakes itself out with people who continue to get trained and continue to grow themselves and continue to do their work versus those who, you know, maybe think it's just a one-time approach to becoming a coach, and then you're a coach and you get to go off in the world and be a coach and not, you know, have to do any of the work yourself, which hopefully there will be less and less of those people. But I have great hope for the coaching industry. I think that it's quite powerful, and I think that it has the potential to really shape future leaders in a very positive way.
So if an individual or a company or organization wanted to connect with you and work with you, what are some things that you want them to think about, or what are some things that you're looking for as well, given that, you know, you're also looking for compatibility?
Yeah. Oh, that's a really great question. I like that question, because I'm often not asked it. I'm often asked by marketers, like, you know, what can we tell people to get them in your doors? And I'm like, no, that's not actually the way we want to approach this. So I love your approach. Yeah. I think the thing that I want you to think about if you want to work with us is, number one, being very clear on the vision and mission that you have for your company. And if you need some help with that, sure, we've got a coach we can pair you with that can help you figure that out. But really, if you're clear on where you're headed and you want to give your people more support than they've ever had, this is the time to bring us in. That you're actually really ready to have tough conversations, to be courageous, to try something that's uncomfortable with your company and see what the results are. We're your people for that. If you are a company that has a problem and you want it quickly solved just to move on and not have this be an entire transformation of your culture, we're probably not your people, to be really clear and transparent. There are people that will come in and do a training for you and call it a day. And we are really interested in a very long-term partnership with a company to support you over time through coaching and training and workshops and keynotes and all kinds of stuff that we can create a really beautiful year or so with you to see what changes. And you can track your own data that way and get your own results. And with our support, end up on the other side. So those are the people we're really interested in working with.
Thank you so much for sharing that, because you're right. This is for the committed. This is for the committed.
Yeah, it definitely is.
And really quickly, we're going to link everything in the show notes of all your different spaces, but someone wants to reach out to you on social media or maybe via another method. What's the best way to get in touch with you, Elena?
Yeah, there's so many options, but you can just go to elenaarmijo.com. That's the simple one. There's a contact form that you can fill out and send my way. You can also go to the c-suitecollective.com. We have another contact form there, and really any social media avenue that you want to send my way, you will find me.
Thank you so much for your time today. This is such a lovely conversation.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for tuning in. If you'd like to connect with me about the podcast or about my services, you can find me on Instagram at Robert Kwong Home, or you can find me through my coaching website at www.robertkwongcoaching.com.